So my goal here is to identify some of the important questions, particularly those that connect to condensed matter physics, high pressure physics. But on this first page, I give the background from a planetary or astrophysical perspective, and many of these questions have, of course, already been identified in Tristan's presentation. I don't want to get into the religious issue of what is a planet and what isn't. For convenience, when I use the word planet, I just mean anything that has degenerate matter or it's close to having degenerate matter. But it never burned hydrogen, so we're not talking about white dwarfs. I'm also cutting off the mass spectrum from below by excluding those planets that are primarily solid, like the Earth. But I am including Uranus and Neptune, as we should throughout this workshop, as objects of great interest in their own right, but also because as the astronomical techniques improve, it will be possible to get good data for objects that are in the Uranus and Neptune mass range, including spectra and so forth. Planetary scientists and astrophysicists are storytellers. They're people who are trying to develop a story of how things came to be. And part of it is just the demographics, identifying what's there, how many planets are there, where are they, how are they distributed. We heard a little bit about that already. We will hear more. Why do planets exist at all? What is it about the process of gravitational aggregation that leads to planets? Where and how do planets form? How is it related to where we find them now? Planets, we have now come to realize, need not end up where they were formed. That may even be true in our solar system, by the way. There are people who have developed ideas where Uranus and Neptune are not now where they formed. They might have formed near where Jupiter formed and got kicked out to where they are now. What are planets made of? Why are they constructed of the material that exists within them? That's part of the storytelling of trying to make sense of the universe we live in. How do planets evolve? How do they behave? Heat and matter fluxes, gravity and magnetic fields, response to perturbation. Those of you in condensed matter physics know the idea of response of a body as in a dielectric constant. Planets also respond. They have parameters that characterize how they respond to external disturbance, be it gravitational, electromagnetic, whatever. Waves and oscillations. What do they look like? Why do they look the way they do? Well, how's that related to what's inside? So these are sort of the big questions as part of the storytelling that an astronomer or planetary scientist wishes to carry out. And from these big questions, one comes to the more specific questions, but still not condensed matter physics questions, which come on a subsequent page. So the specific questions that result from these generic questions have to do with the mass-radius relationship. You want to be able to say something about the nature of the object by observing its radius and mass. These are the things that are most easily measured. They're still quite hard to measure in the case of extrasolar planets, but in principle it will be done. What are the elemental abundances in the planets? And given that you have certain elements, how are those elements associated with each other? What are the phases, the molecules, the electronic states, the associations, ionic or otherwise, of the various constituents? How are those constituents distributed spatially? Do you have cores? Do you have molecular weight gradients? Do you have sharp interfaces? Why might you care about a sharp interface? I'll get to that in subsequent transparencies, but part of the reason, of course, is that it may tell us about the history of the object. Whether or not you have a sharp interface has to do with the history, and also, of course, in the case of phase transitions, whether it's a first-order phase transition. Are there compositional discontinuities? If so, why? Is there a central core? Is it sharply delineated? Is it solid or liquid? Is it stable to long-term interaction with the overlying material? What is the relationship between external and internal composition? We already saw that in some of the things that Tristan was telling us about. You can measure external composition through looking at the spectrum in the case of extrasolar planets. In the case of our own solar system, we have in one instance only, with the Galileo probe, a direct measurement, in situ measurement of the material using a mass spectrometer and other instruments on board that spacecraft to actually tell us what's there. Is the compositional distribution changing with time? It's part of the evolutionary question. You may not be able to measure that directly, but it's a fundamental question for understanding how these objects work. What is the rotation? What are its causes and consequences? Rotation is actually a very interesting aspect of these objects. You'd like to know about the rotation of planets and other systems, just as we're interested in the rotation of stars, because it has to do with how the object formed, whether it could lose angular momentum with outflow, what was the process whereby it formed. It turns out, for example, that the 10-hour rotation that Jupiter has is a fundamental parameter that we do not understand. You can say in a general sense why it should be of that order of magnitude, but why it's 10 rather than 20 or 5 is something we don't know. Is there a deep-seated zonal flow, differential rotation? What causes it? And then, of course, how is the gravity field related to all of this? Jupiter and Saturn, Uranus and Neptune all have measurable high-velocity east-west winds in their atmosphere. That's what I mean by zonal flow. We suspect, but we don't know for sure, that those flows extend down into the interior. In other words, it's not just an atmospheric phenomenon the way that you would think about the jet stream in the Earth's atmosphere. It's something that's connected to the interior. And of course, these planets don't have a surface in the way that the Earth has, so maybe that's not too surprising. But if it is true, then that's of great interest, because you might learn something about the interior by using that flow as a tracer of the processes deep down. Now, how does it vary with latitude? What determines its strength? So forth.
David, could you elaborate just a little bit on that remark you just made about the lack of a surface in the sense of the Earth?
Yes. Well, 2 points to be made there. The first, of course, is that in a thermodynamic sense, there is no sudden jump in material properties in the outermost region of the planet in the way that you have it on Earth, where you have this atmosphere like in this room, which is 10 to the minus 3 CGS units density and stuff, which is more than 1,000 times larger just beneath your feet. There's nothing like that on the giant planets. A more important question might be the stability properties of the atmosphere, that is, whether it is neutrally stable versus statically stable, and maybe Adam will get into that, Adam Sherman, because that also affects whether you couple the flow in the atmosphere to the interior. So even if you have materials of the same composition, you might change the nature of the coupling depending on the stability properties, response of the body to vertical disturbances. But one could certainly, in principle, imagine just having a flow that's driven from above by sunlight, which is the way the Earth's atmospheric flows are driven. Jupiter, of course, having more heat from below than heat from the sun, could perhaps have an engine down at depth, as well as the engine that doubtless exists because of differences between temperature at equator and pole. So you could imagine there's some giant flywheel inside Jupiter as well. So what is the heat flow? What causes the heat flow? What is the process for transporting this heat as a function of depth? What is the temperature profile? Is the convection in layers or top to bottom? Any of you who know anything about geophysics, like Raymond here, will know that this has always been a central question in understanding the inside of the Earth. It's also a central question in understanding giant planets. The extent to which there is a connection, a link between what's down below and what's at the surface, more likely to be a link in the case of giant planets. We don't know that for sure. In the context of the way we think about the Earth, we think about a relationship between the rocks we see at the Earth's surface and the material inside the Earth. In the case of giant planets, of course, it's the connection between the composition of the atmosphere and the composition of the interior.
Save it for the sun.
Yes, and actually in the case of the sun, there isn't an exact correspondence between what you measure in the atmosphere and what's deep down, although it's there's certainly a fairly close correspondence.
That relationship. Down, but below the atmosphere,
yes.
The rotational structure, the magnetic field structure, etc., that you see at the surface reflects some processes that may connect to the radiative boundary and the soil.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. So that's the only comment.
Right. What is the vigor of the convection? Why do you care about that? You care about that because that is likely to be related to the question of whether you have a magnetic field. Are there waves naturally excited? The analogy in the case of the Earth or the Sun is that indeed there are processes that excite waves, seismic waves in that case, which actually tell you about the body. In the case of giant planets, there's some reason to suspect that that's unlikely or at least difficult to detect, but it is an open question. I should, following up on Adam's point, make the comment that in the case of the Sun, some of our best information about the inside of the Sun comes from seismology, helioseismology. And the reason is that the convective motions in the atmosphere have a significant Mach number. That is, the motions are not small in amplitude relative to the speed of sound. And so there is energy pumped into waves, seismic waves, sound waves, which then express themselves in the superficial appearance of the Sun. And so you can actually measure the spectrum of oscillations of the Sun and figure out something about the interior structure. In the case of the Earth, of course, it's done because earthquakes excite seismic waves. Giant planets are unfortunately sort of in between. That is to say, they don't have the solid material that can store stress and then be released suddenly in the way an earthquake does it. They also don't have motions as vigorous, but it's still an open question as to whether there might be some way of naturally exciting waves. If this were so, that would be the best way, unquestionably, of figuring out something about what goes on inside these objects. The gravity field, which Tristan talked about, is a really bad way, sadly, of figuring out the structure inside. It's highly non-unique. It's a highly limited data set. Seismology, by comparison, is a wonderful data set if you had it.
One reviews this discovery proposal later on, was supposed to measure the J2, J4, J6, etc.
Does one recall these words of yours? We were very careful in writing that proposal to not overstate what we could learn about the question of the deep interior, although there were people on our team who were pressuring us, meaning Bill Hubbard and I, to be more positive. But you can learn lots of other things from the J's, which have to do with zonal flow and so on, right?
Without wanting to stretch the analogy, you know this, but others in this room may not, that of course the Earth does exhibit or express its normal modes quasi-continuously due to atmospheric
precipitation. Yes, yeah, good point.
And so that offers a tiny glimmer of hope on the analogy.
That's right. The coupling is kind of bad, but there is the possibility that that processes in the external part of the planet might disturb the interior. By the way, some people thought that you could do that with Comet Shoemaker-Levy. That's an example of a sudden event, the comet hitting Jupiter, exciting waves, but they did not see them. There were waves seen, but they're atmospheric. Is there a magnetic field? If so, why? What structure does it have? What time variability? Magnetic field, if you understood it, would be a wonderful way of figuring out what's going on down below. And there is promise that this will be more possible than right now. At the moment, just because our understanding of the process, the dynamo process, is somewhat limited. it proves difficult to make clean statements about the structure of the planet from knowing the magnetic field. But there's certainly the promise, and there's absolutely no doubt that you want to understand the magnetic field, and of course, understanding the magnetic field requires knowing the conductivity, the kind of experiments that Bill Nellis has done, the theoretical work that some of you can do on conductivity is of great importance. The response to external disturbances, mentioned that already, but just to elaborate slightly on that, if you have an orbiting satellite, such as Io around Jupiter, it disturbs the interior of Jupiter, it creates a tidal bulge. The response of Jupiter to that external gravitational disturbance is expressed both as an amplitude and a phase, if you like, the real and imaginary parts of the response of the system. And that too might be a condensed matter physics problem. It might also just be a fluid dynamical problem. The tidal Q of Jupiter, which is a measure of the anelasticity, the imperfect response of the system, the imaginary part, if you will, that parameter is not understood. It's one of the fundamental parameters of Jupiter. Happens to be about 10 to the 5. It's not understood. When I say not understood, I mean, yes, there are ideas out there, but the theories don't really explain it. And understanding it means to just within an order of magnitude even. I mean, this is something where we don't even understand it to within an order of magnitude or two. And by the way, that's of interest for extrasolar planets. It's of interest in the de-spinning of extrasolar planets, how they respond and so forth. How's the body evolved? What was the temperature and structure in the past? And of course, this is part of the storytelling idea, that you would like to be able to look at the planet right now, figure out what it did in the past, and thereby deduce something about how it formed. Let's go now then to the condensed matter physics questions. And before I do that, let me give you a preliminary about composition, which comes from cosmic chemistry. Tristan has already introduced a little bit of this. We live in a universe where, of course, almost everything is hydrogen and helium. This is what astronomers call the metals, including oxygen, the heavy elements. And of course, we think we understand this distinction. The distinction came about because helium was produced early in the universe as part of the expansion following the Big Bang. And these are elements that are produced in stars and are then ejected from the more massive of those stars back into the interstellar medium, and our solar system and our central star are, of course, using reprocessed material, which includes these elements that came from thermonuclear processes within the stars. And, of course, the important point for our discussion is that these elements are much less abundant than hydrogen and helium as a consequence, and we have to keep this in mind when we talk about what condensed matter physics questions are of greatest importance. Now, this of course is nuclear physics. The relationship, the relative values of these numbers is nuclear physics. That's why, for example, iron, which one would otherwise not think of as likely to be popping up here at all, happens to be showing up there because it's a very stable nucleus. Beyond that, you can basically forget about the rest. But it's also why, of course, oxygen of mass 16, carbon of mass 12, neon of mass 20, which are a certain number of alpha particles. But there's another interesting division of these elements that comes from their physical chemistry. So in addition to the subdivision where we see hydrogen and helium showing up very dominant, and then we see these ones showing up, neon, a little bit of an oddball in a certain sense, but oxygen, carbon, and nitrogen showing up as a group, and then the heavy elements showing up as a group. That's nuclear physics, but it also turns out that these elements, under conditions relevant to the formation of planets, which is low pressure, but sometimes high temperature, that these elements group together in terms of their physical chemistry, and that's why we have, to a first approximation, the three kinds of objects, the terrestrial bodies, which are mostly magnesium, silicon, and iron, and the oxygen that those elements like to combine with. That's what the Earth's made of. The most common atom in the Earth is oxygen, but the reason why it's there is because it combines with magnesium, silicon, and iron. And then we have the icy materials, which can condense in the outer part of the solar system. And that's where most of the oxygen and carbon is, because even after you extract the oxygen and put it in with these elements, oxygen is so abundant you still have plenty left over, and typically that's in the form of water, H2O, because you've got lots of hydrogen. Now the way you play this game is you always look at what is it above where you are that you naturally combine with. So these ones naturally combine with oxygen, turns out, much more so than hydrogen. And oxygen most naturally combines with hydrogen, carbon most naturally with hydrogen. And then of course, the most abundant material of all, if it can be aggregated onto a planet, will lead to the most massive objects because hydrogen is most abundant. So you have the gas-rich bodies, brown dwarfs, and planets. Now, Tristan was telling about the one example of where we have a transit where we actually have a measure of radius, and indeed it fits in with a hydrogen-rich abundance. But let me just make the point that in those cases, which are most, nearly all at the moment, where we only have information about the mass, extrasolar planets, they will be mostly hydrogen. And why can I say that with such a high degree of confidence? Because there ain't nothing else in the universe anywhere near abundant enough to produce objects of the masses we see. You can't make, in normal way of thinking about things, there may be extreme cases like planets around pulsars, but in general you can't make a Jupiter mass planet out of iron. There isn't enough iron around. So that's why we're not interested in Jupiter mass planets made of iron, because we doubt that they exist, because the universe has the remarkable ability to surprise us. So who knows? But that's why we're interested in hydrogen. We're interested in hydrogen because it's at the top of the list, and it also is what drives a great deal of interest in oxygen, carbon. Obviously, it drives interest in helium as well, although one suspects that in some respects helium, at least as a pure substance, is unremarkable. That is, it has a rather simple behavior.
Can you remark on the mass of the planets of hydrogen and helium? You've got some additional figures in red there. That's a more up-to-date.
Sorry, the which?
The figures for abundance of mass of hydrogen and helium.
Oh, over here?
Yes.
Over here? Yeah. Well, there is actually, I mean, there are two comments to be made here. The first is that helium, the amount of helium may vary somewhat through cosmic time, because helium is being created as well. It's not just Big Bang. And there is an issue, it turns out to be an important issue, for exactly how much helium the solar system had at the time it formed. We think it's actually this number, that's why I put it there. But the truth is, we don't actually know. That's one of the things we don't know at this level of accuracy. There's some debate about what is the correct number. It's believed that the primordial sun was 0.272, but that's actually a model. That's not what you measure when you measure the atmosphere of the sun. That comes from the work of John Bacall.
The atmosphere of the sun is about 0.24 or something like that, but
yeah.
Of course helium settles,
yes.
Because it's
heavier
in the radiative zone.
Yeah, the actual observed number in the atmosphere of Jupiter is 0.236 or thereabouts, as Tristan mentioned.
Okay.
and should be compared with... Now, there is another place in the solar system, by the way, where you might possibly measure the primordial helium, and that's Uranus and Neptune. Not absolutely certain, but that's a good candidate place because it could be the helium and hydrogen are mixed in the true original value and have it undergone change subsequently. Water is about most abundant condensate in the universe, following from the oxygen, and so forms an important role in our thinking of the material that can condense. So we have these three categories of material: gas, ice, and rock. Gas meaning hydrogen and helium, ice meaning carbon, oxygen, combined with whatever they want to primarily combine with, which is usually hydrogen, and rock, which is basically everything else. And of course, they have very different equations of state. For the purpose of what I'm trying to get at right now, it's not important that that we know these things imperfectly. What's important right now is just to remind you that there's an enormous difference in this pressure range. This is 1 megabar right here. It's an enormous difference between the behavior of hydrogen or hydrogen helium, behavior of ice, the behavior of rock. So they behave very differently. And that's why we can say with such great confidence that when you see an object about the size of Jupiter, that it has to be mostly hydrogen. It's an unavoidable thing because you can't fiddle around. You can't bring this up to here with any sort of reasonable temperature. These are very well separated in density. By the way, that difference collapses as you go to very high pressure. It's still there because of the fact that you only have one electron per massive particle in hydrogen, and you have one electron per two massive particles for everything else because of all the neutrons. So hydrogen is always just special. The difference collapses in Thomas Fermi theory at higher pressures for everything else. But in this pressure range, there's very nice separation.
Those are zero temperature? These are actually
80 bats, but they're 80 bats. But, you know, precisely which temperature doesn't matter. I think it corresponds to a few thousand degrees up here. But, you know, the difference between an 80 bat and isotherm down here is relatively small. It's even relatively small here. It is important down here, of course.
The very tight error bars on this mysterious stuff, rock, tends to suggest a compositional independence of the equation of state, and hence a universality. Are you using some universal?
No.
No, you didn't.
You know, if I was talking to Earth scientists, I would not, of course, dare to do this at all. You know, this is only to make the distinction between those three categories and not to get into... I mean, we do have to get into the subtleties, but at this stage, I'm just making the distinction at that level. Another way to think about composition is to recognize that if we've got three components, we can draw a triangle. If you've got three of anything, you can draw a triangle. And you put the three things at the vertices. Earth scientists relate naturally to these diagrams, by the way, because this is how compositions are often plotted for rocks. But here I put ice here, I put rock here, and gas at that vertex. And then, of course, you can plot any object you like. Jupiter and Saturn are up near this vertex, but not at it. Slightly away from it because they've got ice and rock. And by the way, we don't know the right ice to rock ratio. But we know, as Trishan discussed, that you've moved away from there, either in part because of a core that formed first, but certainly at the very least material added later. This stands for large icy satellites like Ganymede, Callisto, Titan. Uranus and Neptune sitting up in a somewhat funny place. One thinks of Uranus and Neptune as perhaps being something like this, only bigger, and then having some gas added, moving it away from this line. The Earth sits right here, very, very close to that vertex. one can, of course, also construct a 3D. Yes?
I believe we could have some area where Uranus and Neptune could fit.
Yes.
They could
yes.
be
yeah, yeah, yeah. Sure, sure, sure.
And yeah. Or stacks of rocks with more.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm sure we will get back to this. Actually, that's something I've pushed for many years. We don't really know where Uranus and Neptune sit in this diagram. This sort of represents a very large cloud, which I haven't attempted to identify of possible compositions. If you've got three compositions and you only know density in some region, you can do all sorts of things. You can move it. There's a lot of degrees of freedom. Especially for Uranus and Neptune, much greater uncertainty than Jupiter and Saturn. Jupiter and Saturn, you can be sort of more confident just because it's close to the vertex. Uranus and Neptune are not close to any vertex, and as a consequence, the uncertainty is large if you're willing to mix ice, rock, and gas in various recipes. We're interested here mostly in higher mass objects that I'm showing here, but just to provide context, I've taken this diagram and moved it out in the dimension of mass. So this is the same diagram, ice, rock, gas, Jupiter near the vertex. But now I've also put mass in here in Earth units, so these are low mass things. But that gives you a sort of broader perspective. And of course, as one goes further in this direction, out to higher masses, we expect things to cluster up close to this vertex because of cosmic abundance considerations. But as you go below this mass, there are actually lots of things you could imagine in the universe which we haven't found yet. Things that are less massive than Jupiter but made of stuff like Jupiter. Things that are more massive than Ganymede but made of ice and rock in equal mixtures. That's what I mean by super Ganymede. It's kind of fun to think about. Some of these things will eventually be found, I bet. So that's the cosmochemical perspective. Let me now go back to my handout and pose the condensed matter physics questions. What do we need if we are to figure out what these objects are doing? Well, one way to think about it, at least the thermodynamics of it, is of course to recognize that if somebody gives you a free energy, you can derive all sorts of wonderful things from it. First derivatives, which are the equation of state, that's what directly goes into the equation of hydrostatic equilibrium, from which you get the radius mass relationship. Second derivatives are also important, and remember that whenever you take second derivatives of anything, errors become larger, so there are instances where you need to know the free energy quite accurately, and most of you in the condensed matter community, I'm sure, realize that, but you know, this process of getting from here to here is demanding on your theory, or for that matter on your experiments. If your experiments require derivatives, sometimes you can measure these things directly. But of course, you have to know the chemistry. That is, you have to do Gibbs thermodynamics, not just Helmholtz thermodynamics. You have to think about chemical potentials. You have to think about what's the lowest chemical potential of the system, what aggregate of atoms is favored. That's what I mean by chemistry. And of course, you need to identify discontinuities, multiple branches, if you will, of the free energy diagram, the phase boundaries. And of course, we're in a regime where at megabar pressures, you're at many thousands of degrees Kelvin, so one expects in most instances that if there are phase boundaries, they've got to be fluid-fluid. Perhaps primarily electronic, in principle, you could imagine something else. And you need to know partitioning. Gibbs told us, of course, as we observe in everyday life, that if you have a phase boundary between two materials and they're not single component systems, then there will be discontinuities in composition across that phase boundary in accordance with the Gibbs phase rules. And then of course you need the transport properties. Now, the extent to which these are important is a complicated issue. Sometimes they're not particularly important because you can decide by a crude calculation that something else is more important. But there are instances where you would like to know thermal conductivity of these systems, or opacity. Now, I should explain that this is a terminology question. If you're in a medium which is condensed, unlike an atmosphere, then you can talk about conductivity but mean opacity. That is, it's just a question of mean free path of something or other, whether it's a phonon or whether it's a photon, determines whether you're talking about conductivity in the way we normally use the word, or opacity. But the basic point is, you're transporting heat by some means, and the question is, with what efficiency? Electrical conductivity is certainly important because, as I explained, you want to make some sense out of the presence or absence of a magnetic field. All of the giant planets have magnetic fields. We don't yet know about the extra solar planets. Very likely they do. And electrical conductivity will characterize the region within which you might be able to generate a magnetic field. There are some instances, and that's what these brackets mean to indicate that this is usually less important, but not always. There are some instances where you'd like to know atomic diffusion, diffusion of X through Y, diffusion of helium through hydrogen. And the reason is that there are some instances like, for example, the formation of helium raindrops inside Jupiter and Saturn, where you would like to know the rate at which helium can find its way to a droplet and become part of that droplet. Often you only want to know this to an order of magnitude, and usually you can get by with simple scaling laws that go back to Einstein and so forth. But there are some instances where you'd like to know it better, or where you would worry about whether you've got it right, whether there might be some other behavior. The same applies with shear or bulk viscosity. We're talking liquids here. And as most of you doubtless know, there's a connection between these two things, usually. But there are some unusual instances in materials, especially multi-phase systems, where you can get strange things happening. And the point I want to make to you all is that very often, the viscosity is not of interest because it's so small that you can basically ignore it. But if there were an instance where it was large, that's what I mean by anomalous, then you'd be interested in it because it has to do with dissipation, how the system dissipates energy. Let me just give you one example of that, and that's a phone. If you take silica, SiO2, and heat it up so that it becomes a mixture of liquid and vapor. It becomes highly compressible because when you squeeze it, most of the compression is taken up in the gas component, but most of the mass could still be in the liquid. That's a system that has a very low sound speed. It's highly dissipative because of irreversible entropy production at the phase boundary between the gas and the liquid. I'm using that example because it's actually been studied in the lab to some extent. The system, an even simpler system, is just steam, water. That happens to be a volcanological interest in the case of steam as the gas component with silica or with any other liquid magma. So that's an example of a system that has an anomalous response, highly dissipated. And you could imagine circumstances where that might be of interest inside a planet. There are some cases, and I want to alert you to this if any of you are imaginative enough, where you would worry about kinetics and metastability. Can you imagine anything that might go on inside Jupiter and Saturn where, as you take a parcel of fluid and move it from one place to another, it does not instantaneously adjust to the new pressure and temperature in the thermodynamic sense? We know of many systems in the laboratory where the adjustment is imperfect. That's especially true in solids, but it might even be true in fluids. Exactly what timescale we're talking about depends on the process in question. In some cases, it might be seconds, more typically hours, in case of the tidal response, for example. Or it might even be days. It might have to do with convection. Or it might even be years. But if there were any sort of kinetic process, metastability means, of course, staying on one branch of the free energy and not jumping immediately to another. It's another way of getting dissipation. So that's of interest if you can think of a circumstance where the metastability is large enough. Let's now go to the specific things that we would like to understand. Starting, obviously, at the top of the list in cosmic abundance, which is hydrogen, the dominant constituent in Jupiter and Saturn, and most extrasolar planets, we suspect. And one obvious question, of course, already been posed, it's been sitting there now for decades, is whether or not there is a first-order phase transition at the temperatures of interest. And I've called it the PPT, but it could be anything. It doesn't have to be the PPT as people understand it. If there is a first-order phase transition, 5,000 Kelvin, 10,000 Kelvin, megabar, 2 megabars, half a megabar, choose your number, that's of great interest. And for that matter, any other first-order phase transition at still higher pressure and somewhat higher temperature.
What's the nature of the transition?
Could there be part of the question is what kind of transition, but the other is whether it's first order. Now, what's the issue with first order?
For just a second, what is the nature of the transition in xenon, which I believe has been metallized in the lab? What's the nature of that transition?
Can somebody answer that? I'm not sure. So it might be second order. Which, yeah.
We need to prove it now.
Yes. Let me.
I mean, fluids are different than solids, so the terminology is going to be different.
Let me just say a few words about why first order phase transitions matter. The first thing you might think of is actually probably the least important, and that's the density structure. It is, of course, true that if I have a jump in density in some place in the planet, that will change the radius-mass relationship through the equation of state. And I'm not saying that that's completely unimportant, but it's probably less important than the other things I've listed here. The reason is that usually, at least in my experience, if you take a system where you think there's a first-order phase transition and just run a line through an interpolation in the sense of Tristan-Guyot's models, it's often, not always true, and it depends on the accuracy that you're trying to reach, but it's often true that you sort of get a similar behavior, at least in the radius-mass relationship. Maybe not in the higher harmonics of the gravity field, but it's often true that an interpolation that smooths out a phase transition will give you a very similar radius as a function of mass with or without. But more importantly, actually a little bit more speculatively, because this is not fully understood, it is possible that when you have a first-order phase transition, that the behavior of the system changes in respect of transport and distribution of constituents. Remember that a first-order phase transition has an entropy discontinuity. That's part of the definition of a first-order phase transition. If it were so that the convection is inhibited across the phase transition, and Edsel, Peter, and I wrote a paper on this 25 years ago, where we said that in fact it would be so, then there will be an entropy discontinuity. There will be a little bit of a thermal boundary layer, but to a first approximation, the temperature will be continuous, but the entropy will be discontinuous. And why does that matter? It matters because it has been standard practice for decades to link the temperature and density in the sense of specific entropy at the top of the planet to what's down below. In fact, Bill Hubbard developed this idea at great length by saying that if you knew the entropy, specific entropy of a parcel of material at 1 bar atmospheric pressure, an observable part of the atmosphere. That told you the entropy way, way down in the center of the planet, which is wonderful if true. Because then you've got, that of course is what we mean by an adiabatic structure, then you've got a simple thermodynamic path that defines relationship of temperature to pressure as you go down. Now, Tristan Guyot, of course, as he mentioned in passing, has added an additional complication, which is that right up here, actually very close to the surface on a crude diagram like this, there might even be a radiative zone below the observable atmosphere, and that will also produce an entropy discontinuity.
What do you mean by
radiative zone? Radiative zone means that you have a place where the opacity is low enough so that you can transport the heat by photons instead of by convection. And Tristan has that at sort of kilobar pressures, 1,000, 1,500 Kelvin thereabouts. And that will also, that will in fact lower the entropy of the interior relative to the atmosphere because, of course, the radiative zone must be sub-adiabatic, has a temperature gradient less than the adiabat.
I think that's like a point here that the question of convective overshoot comes up.
Yes.
I mean, in stars, even in massive stars where the eddy velocities are very slow relative to the sound
speed,
there's a tremendous amount of evidence now that there's overshoot of order, you know, quarter of a scale vertically. So, in the sense that you don't really, even in the case, so I guess to say that more generally, is that it's not clear to me at all that even if you have this entropy discontinuity, that you really inhibit.
I agree. That's what I said when I introduced this point by saying somewhat more speculatively, etc. It happens to be a quite difficult question to answer as to whether, now there is a phase transition, this is not a compositional, or although composition may be part of it, but you know, it has to do with the, you know, as you move a parcel, because it's a low viscosity system, it is overshoot in the sense you're describing. You can also excite waves at the interface, which may break and so forth. And that's seen in the lab, by the way, in analog systems where you use salt and sugar and so forth, double diffusive convection. So the question of how thick a layer, two-phase layer is created, we thought it was thin. But I don't know. That's a complicated question. That's a fluid dynamical question that we don't fully understand.
Well, with the if you believe the calculations by Saumon and Strada, the entropy discontinuity is large. It's the one you assume with Peter as well. But
it might be smaller.
Boltzmann constant covariant. So the density discontinuity is about from 0.8 to 1 or 1.1 gram per cubic centimeter. And so the if you have a parcel going up the transition, its buoyancy will be very small and it will get down very rapidly. So in that case, overshooting will be very difficult or very limited.
Yeah, one of the parameters that matters in this problem is the ratio of convective velocity to a characteristic velocity that you can derive from a density difference. And this number is much, much, much less than 1. So in that simple inertial sense, convective overshoot is small. But it's more complicated than that. But Tristan reminded me of something else, and that is, of course, don't think of this first-order, non-first-order question as being yes, no, in the following sense. If you are close to the critical point, then the first order aspect of the system might be small. And so there might, you know, it depends on how close you are to the critical temperature. And so if you're slightly below the critical temperature, then the first order effects vanishing towards zero, of course they may vanish as square root, you know, it's a parabola, so it may still be a big effect. But
isn't it 30 Kelvin? For hydrogen? Isn't the critical point 30 Kelvin for hydrogen?
Oh, no, I'm talking about the critical point of the plasma phase transition. It has to be an upper critical temperature, right? The question is, what is it? It was on one of Tristan's diagrams. Here's my version. I'm talking about this point, the question of whether you are above or below that point. That's the point above which it ceases to be first order. There must be such a point. if the transition exists at all. And you know, and here's a Jupiter 80 bat, and here are various other 80 bats.
Might be pointed out that one of the mechanisms for exciting modes
yes.
of Jupiter would be
yes.
this type of...
Yes, yes, indeed. Indeed, if there were a first order phase transition, this is one place of introducing a new time scale into the system. It's a way of coupling processes that one would normally think are long time scale into shorter time scale processes. This is well known in convective systems where you have convection impinging on a stably stratified region, that you can excite waves in the stably stratified region, whereas in the neutrally stable region you have this fluctuating but longer time scale convective motion. Just to finish my point about phase transitions, I already mentioned this earlier, but let me just remind you again that J. Willard Gibbs told us that you have to equate chemical potentials across a phase boundary between phase 1 and phase 2 for each element X, and in general that equation will have a solution in which the amount of this element is different on the two sides. This is a fluid system. In solids, by the way, this is often inhibited. So people don't worry quite as much about this for a purely solid system in the case of the Earth, say. But in a fluid system, this is of great importance because with the action of convection and thin boundary layers, convection may help you to deliver the information of this equation to the rest of the fluid. So that if the phase boundary says, hey, I want a helium difference between here and here, then convection will carry that information above and below, maybe. It's not obvious that it will, but often it will, so that the atmosphere will see a different composition because of the imposition of the phase transition at megabar pressures. This changes the structure of the planet, also changes in principle the evolution of the planet, because it could be that the planet is pumping material. It may actually be using some of its thermal energy to redistribute material upwards. This is not, remember, this is thermodynamics. Thermodynamics does not require that the material at lower pressure be less dense than the material at higher pressure in respect of this constituent, this other constituent. Le Chatelier's rule does, by the way, say that for a single phase, but in a multi-phase system, you could, in principle, have the low-pressure phase have more helium than the high-pressure phase, for example. So this might even be a system that wants to pump helium up. No evidence, of course, in the atmosphere that this is happening, which is actually one of the reasons why I personally think that the plasma phase transition doesn't exist. But, you know, there are many things happening, so I wouldn't push that point too strongly. In any event, it's something we need to understand. We need to know the partitioning across phase transitions.
Can you elaborate on that a little bit? Let's say convection were happening across that boundary, and then what would be the mechanism for keeping with it? I mean, would that be a process that would counteract what you're discussing?
You're asking whether, if convection, if the convection were vigorously crossing this phase boundary, that tends to make the composition uniform. What I'm saying here is that if we're right that the convection does not vigorously cross the phase boundary, then what happens is that you get this redistribution effect taking place. So obviously the outcome is not determined just by thermodynamics. It's determined by understanding the fluid dynamics. So this is a very interesting case of where you need to understand both of those fields to get the answer.
I must admit, I think they're trying to figure out theoretically whether this type of convective overshoot or convective excitation of modes, global modes over Jupiter, is more important than people are feeling.
I'm not sure how easy it is to observe, but it seems like a fascinating possibility for exciting
mode. I agree.
It can allow you to probe all the way down to the phase
range. I agree. Yeah, the mode spectrum, of course, changes if you have a phase transition. Of course, this is well known for people who study seismology. Introduce an interface and you suddenly get a whole bunch of new modes.
You have this true metallic halogen on your transistor. To what extent does actually the properties of this supposedly metallic machine matters? Just conductivity? Is there anything else you need?
What is it?
For which question?
No. You had true metallic halogen in the second phase. You talked a lot about that might be a phase transition. Okay. If you put this question, is there anything specific about labeling the second state metallic that's important for your modeling? Is it the conductivity you need or?
For the questions I've just been discussing, the main issue is the thermodynamics, not, for example, conductivity. Now, conductivity is important to a limited extent in understanding the boundary layers. I mean, this is a fluid dynamical problem, and fluid dynamicists care about, for example, the Prandtl number. Prandtl number is a ratio of kinematic viscosity to thermal diffusivity. So there's an example where transport properties even come in, but they come in through the fluid dynamical part of the problem. So the primary question is thermodynamics. Is there a first order phase transition? If so, how does material partition across it? And then if you want to tackle this very difficult problem of what actually happens at a phase transition fluid dynamically, you also need at least a rough estimate, and sometimes an order of magnitude estimate is good enough, of the transport properties, because they determine the boundary layer thickness, the part right at the interface where transport is by molecular and electronic processes rather than by bulk transport.
This means there's nothing specific that makes the second state metallic. There's nothing important for your models to say that this is metallic. It could be anything.
I'm making a general statement about any first order phase transition, no matter what it is, because it comes from general abuse. So it's a general statement, doesn't it?
There was a question from the left side.
Yeah, okay.
What you had by the word true.
You had one of your earlier slides, you had the phrase, is there a transition at even higher pressures to a true metallic hydrogen? What do you mean by true metallic?
I'll let Neil handle that one, although he may not. Neil doesn't believe in true metallic hydrogen anymore, perhaps. I don't know. This is a hypothesis. A hypothesis. It goes back to Binger and Huntington. One has this wonderful notion that if you went to high enough pressure, maybe you got something really simple, which had a very high electrical conductivity, and didn't have these peculiar properties that your stuff has.
Figure Huntington did their calculation at T equals zero.
But this is temperature much less than Fermi temperature, so I would have thought of it was...
It's a very disordered system with unusual dynamics, which I'll tell you about.
It's a different system than that.
Once you get into this disordered liquid, you can't get to that system.
Well, in my naive picture, the difference between 0 and 10,000 Kelvin in respect of the state I'm imagining is negligible.
Right, but physically it's not. Physically, it's not.
That's correct.
All the way that you think the mechanism for metallization is totally different. So what...
I accept that. But the question is whether at some higher pressure, like say 10 megabars, choose your number, the system becomes simpler. That's the question I'm posing. No, I mean that there is no longer a funny correlation among the protons. It behaves like a simple metal. Now, I'm not advocating this. I'm just saying maybe there is such a thing.
I don't see what's so radical about it. I mean, there's two different contexts in which you can discuss this. This is one that is now probable by experiment, which goes up to maybe 3 kilobars on that order and involves the transition. There's a lot of interesting physics there we're hear a lot about. But in these objects, including ground dwarfs, we're getting up to gigabar pressures.
Yeah.
And under those circumstances, it's hard to believe that the concept of true simple metal is not germane.
Again, it depends on the definition. In a system like that, the mean free path is going to be, you know, extremely small. And the conductivity isn't going to be much different than what we measure.
A two-component plasma, a simple two-component plasma.
I mean, it's probably a debatable point.
Gigabar pressures?
I'm sure.
It's a liquid. I mean, at the first, at the plasma. Ooh, sorry, I used that word. When you're discussing the possibility of a first-order phase transition, it's a very disordered system.
Sure, but that's a megabar pressure.
Right.
Now, the question I'm
You're asking other questions about it would have to freeze. In order to be a solid, it would have to change its structure to that of a solid from the disordered liquid. I mean, something physically is going to happen to change the nature of the system from a disordered one to one.
I think we're talking across purposes.
Yeah.
At 1 megabar, there is not yet a big difference between the various energy terms in the system, mm-hmm. you know, like the Fermi energy, the electrons, etc. If you go to high enough pressure, there will be. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, I don't know if it's 10 or 100 megabars or what, but at some pressure, there's absolutely no question that the Fermi energy will be enormously larger than anything else you name.
It's already there at 1.5 megabars.
No, it's not.
Well, it's one for, I mean, the real temperature.
And that's why I said there are two different contexts. There's one, the low pressure regime, what's the low? It's the megabar regime, and it's the gigabar, et cetera, regime. Both of those are of relevance in the planetary, and particularly in the ground world context.
We will have plenty of time to argue about this forever. Let me. What's the time? 12:40. I'm not going to get through this, but that doesn't matter. Let me, because we can have other opportunities to talk about this more. But let me say a little bit about the other questions with hydrogen. In some models for what happens in this transitional range that we have just been debating, there are anomalous thermodynamic properties. For example, in the simple model that comes originally from Mavros, who will be here later in the week, by the way, hydrogen, pure hydrogen, actually has a negative coefficient of thermal expansion and a negative Grunheisen parameter over a limited pressure range. Now, by the way, alpha and gamma have to have the same sign from fundamental Maxwell relationships of thermodynamics and stability. So negative alpha goes with negative gamma. Why is that interesting? It's interesting because if you had such a system, convection would be shut off. You can't carry heat out from a hotter place to a colder place with a negative coefficient of thermal expansion. So that's of great interest if it is so. And it's even of interest if it's small but positive. Obviously, we want to improve the accuracy of the equation of state in this transitional pressure range with or without a phase transition. We have to know the electrical and thermal properties, especially, I would say, electrical. Of course, to the extent that Wiedemann Franz has any value, there may be a link. It's not clear that Wiedemann Franz will work. Are there anomalous dissipated processes? I've already mentioned that. Metastable states. With helium, the central question still, 30 years after the recognition that this was an important question, the central question still is the solubility of helium in hydrogen as a function of pressure and temperature, especially at these pressures of order a megabar. It could be solubility of helium in a system where there are only a limited number of free electrons, a low conduction C density, if you will. In fact, it's known experimentally that helium is highly insoluble, even in fairly low electron density metals, which are most metals, actually, relative to the simple picture of metallic hydrogen. The question of how that solubility varies with pressure and temperature is central to understanding whether you partition. Related to that question, not identical to it, but closely related to it, is non-ideality. You can show from simple free energy models that, of course, the question of solubility is linked to non-ideality. If you think about writing out the free energy, you have an ideal entropy of mixing term, and then you have a what's called an X times 1 minus X term, where X is compositional variable with a positive coefficient that measures the unmixing. In the classic chemist's approach to phase transitions in multi-component systems, and of course that term, which creates limited solubility, also creates non-ideality. That's what we mean by non-ideality. That's one of the sources, not the only ones, one of the important sources of non-ideality, which physically just means that if you take a helium atom and plop it in hydrogen, it doesn't like to be there. That it would prefer to be surrounded by others of its own kind. It's not particularly gregarious. Now, Tristan mentioned, of course, the general issue of solubility for other elements as well. Let me just quickly explain this point. In the case of any element, if we have it dispersed at the elemental level in a phase which I put as metallic in quotation marks, and we want to compare that with the chemical potential of the system where all the helium atoms or whatever have aggregated into a single phase. Of course, there will still be a little bit of the other phase still there because of the entropy of mixing term. But to a good approximation, one can then write down chemical potentials for each, one of which has an entropy of mixing term and has this additional unfavorable Gibbs energy of insertion. Think of it, in the case of helium, as the additional energy that it costs to stick a helium atom into hydrogen relative to surrounding it by helium. Then, of course, you can solve that equation in standard form to get the solubility X, mole fraction, as a function of the Gibbs energy of insertion and KT. And the reason why I'm doing this for you is to remind you of a basic point, which is that because helium is so much more abundant than the other impurities, the interesting energies at which helium becomes insoluble are considerably smaller, like, say, an electron volt or two, which corresponds, of course, to temperatures of 10,000 or so. If you have oxygen and carbon and these other things present in cosmic abundance or close to cosmic abundance, factor 2 or 3, then in order for them to become insoluble as elements, you need larger energies here, and so that makes it less likely, but you still, of course, want to solve the problem. I haven't solved the problem here, I'm just defining the problem for you. And what I'm getting at here, of course, is something that I'm sure you all know, at least instinctively, which is that some impurity which is present in low abundance is more likely to be soluble, other things being equal, than an impurity that is present in high abundance. It's just an elementary concept of subsaturation versus supersaturation. Of course, these things may not be present in their elemental form, so you have to know how oxygen, etc., are actually behaving. As Tristan already mentioned, we really want to understand oxygen. Very important to understand oxygen, and that means water or whatever happens to oxygen in the presence of hydrogen. So it's not just H2O in the ratio 2:1 atomically. It's also mixtures of hydrogen and water. At low pressure, of course, hydrogen and water don't like to mix. The low pressure phase diagram is known. Low pressure means kilobars, fluid pressure kilobars. What's the solubility of oxygen and hydrogen? Are there oxygen-hydrogen alloys? What are their properties? Are there inclusion compounds? We know, by the way, that hydrogen and water, this is Russ Henley's work and other people working with him at Geophysical Lab, there are inclusion compounds. That means water ice inside of which hydrogen is happy to sit. Only van der Waals bonded. It's not bonded to the water molecule, as you can imagine. They don't like to bond. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about something like it, but at much higher temperatures and pressures. It's pure speculation. Of course, if oxygen does have limited solubility, that is, wants to form droplets and actually settle out, you would like to know the behavior of pure oxygen as well, and in fact, you pretty much have to know it in order to solve the problem. But it's a conditional thing. If it should turn out that oxygen is of limited solubility, then you're going to have to know what pure oxygen does, because that will be a legitimate phase in the system. There's another non-negligible carrier of oxygen other than water, and that's all these guys, the things that are responsible for making oxygen the most common atom inside the Earth. The Earth's mantle, by the way, in case you didn't realize it, is basically an assembly of oxygen atoms with the heavy guys stuffed in the interstices, because oxygen atoms are large. So you would want to know what those guys do as well. Carbon, well, this is one question that has received significant attention, more attention than oxygen, even though carbon is slightly less abundant, but obviously it's of great importance. It's a somewhat simpler system, maybe that's why it attracts interest, but also there's been a long-standing interest, of course, in the question of diamond, metallic carbon, and so forth. And if there is some work, and I imagine from Raymond or Robin, we'll hear about that. There is experimental work that pertains to this question of the stability of hydrocarbons at high pressure. But of course, you also want to know what happens when the methane is strongly diluted in hydrogen. Remember, by the way, that carbon to hydrogen solar is 10 to the minus 4. We should not lose sight of the possibility that carbon-oxygen bonding is part of understanding what carbon does and what oxygen does. To be sure, there's lots of hydrogen around, but that's still an important question. Neon. Not only is neon cosmically abundant, cosmically speaking, it's much more abundant than the stuff that you are currently breathing in and out of your lungs. Not much more, but somewhat more. Not only is it cosmically abundant, but it's also a tracer, I suspect, of internal processes, because as Tristan mentioned, the Galileo probe, when it entered the atmosphere of Jupiter, saw a depletion, a strong depletion, by a factor of 10 in neon relative to cosmic. What I think is happening with neon is that it is partitioning even more strongly than helium into helium raindrops. Now that may, if you've never done a calculation like this, that may sound a little strange, but actually what happens is that neon by itself is not insoluble in hydrogen under the abundance conditions of interest because it has low abundance relative to helium. But once a favorable phase is produced, which is what the helium does by making raindrops, then the neon just loves to be with the helium. So the neon gets soaked up by the helium raindrops. That's what I think is happening, and you can do a calculation that shows that it's reasonable. But it does require, by the way, that in an absolute sense, neon be more insoluble, less soluble than helium. And somebody has to do the theoretical calculation. I've done some rough calculations, but it would be wonderful to understand the electronic energy of neon as an impurity state. Take hydrogen, your model of hydrogen, put a neon atom in, how much does the energy change?
In hydrogen and in helium, right?
Sorry?
Comparatively in hydrogen and helium.
That's right, yes.
Is there a simple explanation for why neon would partition but not krypton, argon, and xenon?
Yes. In the language of pseudopotentials, those heavier noble gases have a less repulsive potential with respect to electrons, and it's because they have nearby conduction levels. They're fluffier atoms, they have a lot of nearby states. That's also why xenon is metallizable. It's in general true, by the way, in the periodic table, that as you go down the periodic table, you get more and more metals because you've got lots of overlapping electronic states and so forth. So xenon, of course, has been known for decades to have chemistry. And that's part of the same issue, that it, you know, can form a variety of compounds. Just recently, somebody has created a chemical compound involving argon. Argon is sort of transitional in this respect. But xenon and krypton certainly have chemistry, much more readily metallizable. We think that neon is very hard to metallize. There are theoretical calculations on the metallization of neon. I forget the number, but it's a very high transition pressure. That's one way to think about it.
David, on the other hand, these things are very considerably more polarizable.
Yes.
You would expect fluctuational fractions to tell just the reverse, wouldn't you?
Mm-hmm.
So there's some kind of balance here?
There could be. I don't know. I should explain. I've not tried to do a calculation for the heavier noble gases, so I'm just telling you my best guess as to why they behave the way they do. There is no, well, Raymond may be able to talk about this because Raymond and his group have worked on xenon in iron, right?
Yeah.
Iron is complicated material. It's not quite the same thing as talking about just an electron gas, but there may be a related, there may be a relationship between those experiments and what I'm talking about in terms of the behavior of xenon in general in metals. By the way, solubility, measuring noble gas solubility in metals is very hard because it's very low solubility. People have tried to do this for decades. It's relevant for nuclear reactor design. So there is some work on it, but a lot of it's not very good. I didn't mean that. I want to finish at one, but I am. There's other stuff I could have shown, but this will do fine. Nitrogen, of course, you know what happens to ammonia, so on. We're getting down into the dirt. Magnesium, silicon, iron. There is, by the way, a relatively low pressure question I'd like to interest some people here in, which is the condensation of magnesium, silicon, and iron inside Jupiter. Okay? So you go down below the measured observable atmosphere of Jupiter, the temperature goes up, the pressure goes up. Eventually, at some place close to where Tristan believes there may be a radiative zone, you will reach the temperature below which you would expect silicates to condense. Now, normally in this room, for example, the pressure in this room, if you take typical silicate compounds, they will condense at sort of 1500 Kelvin, something like that, or 1800 Kelvin, actually. At even lower pressures, when planets formed, it's somewhat lower temperature. It's a pressure-dependent effect. When you go up in pressure, the non-ideal thermodynamics starts to play a role. And you would like to know what comes out. I mean, is it a water-rich silicate droplet that forms? I mean, does water like to aggregate onto this? We know, by the way, that SiO2 and H2O, silica and water, can mix in all proportions if you go to high enough temperature. That's an experimentally verified fact. So an interesting question of how these things combine. So there's a condensation question under non-ideal conditions. And of course, the general question, what happens to terrestrial materials at extreme pressure? With or without an enormous amount of hydrogen? Are there even hydrides? Are there particular combinations? We know of these at low pressure. Silane, SiH4, is a combination of silicon and hydrogen, which is normally not expected at low pressure because Si just loves to be with oxygen. But in atmospheres of stars, one gets these things, but maybe also at high pressure. Do all these terrestrial things dissolve in hydrogen at high pressure? What's the melting point of this stuff? By the way, some people have wondered, you might think this is unimportant, but actually it could be important, have wondered about whether this central core of Jupiter is solid or liquid. It's not obvious, it turns out. The pressures go from 40 to maybe 100 megabars. Pressure goes up rather steeply, even though the mass is small because the density is very high. Density is about 20 grams per cc, sort of like uranium at 1 bar. Now, what is the melting point of that thing? It might actually be important because that's one place where you might get dissipation if you're near or at the melting point, or below the melting point. So that's even a possible contributor to tidal effects.
What's the temperature?
The temperature might be 10,000, 20,000.
But that's got to be small for tides, right? I mean, this is a huge part of the.
Yeah.
High power, right? I mean,
yeah. In terms of tidal Q, Jupiter as a whole, tidal Q 10 to the 5, say.
Yes.
If the tidal Q of that core is 10, it's enough.
Okay.
But you're right, of course, this is an enormous inverse cube geometric attenuation.
So if it's molasses.
There are solids, by the way, that have a Q of 10. Heavy and noble gases, already mentioned that. Cosmic soup. Well, of course, in the end, I think of this more as a soup than a cocktail because it's hot. I mean, you could also have cold soups, but that's only California, right? Cold soups are not real, unless you like Vichy Schwa. Okay, cosmic soup. What's the phase diagram of cosmic soup? What I'm getting at here, of course, is that, of course, you want to break the problem up into manageable chunks. And once you go beyond a single component, the most manageable thing is a binary phase diagram. But it's well known in many systems, in fact, the inside of the Earth, that that you can't understand the system as a set of binary phase diagrams. That you really have to, unfortunately, go to the multi-component system. So, but that's a question. I pose it as a question. Can one understand it as a set of binary diagrams, or is it irreducibly n-ary, where n is the number of components of interest? And you also want to do this not just for cosmic, which is overwhelmingly hydrogen, but somewhat hydrogen depleted. That's important for Uranus, Neptune, objects that did not grab all the hydrogen. And you want the transport properties. Bill Nellis, of course, has done electrical conductivity experiments on synthetic Uranus, which is sort of in this spirit. Finally, a general challenge to theorists. Is it possible to develop a general framework for many of these questions, or do you have to break it up into special cases and use tailored techniques for each of these? It would be wonderful if there were some sort of accepted, sufficiently accurate procedure for addressing many of these questions, which everybody agreed to was a reasonable way of doing things. It may not be true, but that's the question I pose, and I hope that Neil and others will rise to the challenge and say something about it. And then, of course, it would also be nice if should such a thing exist. These days we have fast workstations, of course, so the computational challenges are more manageable. But one would hope that you don't have to do everything by Dave Sepoli's.
well, it's becoming easier.
quite a Monte Carlo with all those nasty nodes. So there is a compromise question, and this is actually quite a profound question, I think, in this science. Yes, of course, we have fast workstations, but I believe, based on my own experience in the field, that it's also nice to have quick and dirty things, and the question is, are there quick and dirty things that are accurate enough? And I have lots of other stuff, but I'll stop.